News, I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Trump is reaching out to try to make a deal to end a partial government shutdown in the United States. AP's Ed Donahue reports a meeting is possible Wednesday.
On Twitter, President Trump asked, "Let's make a deal." A source tells the AP the president invited House and Senate leaders from both parties to the White House for a briefing on border security. In his tweet, the president said dealing with border security, the wall, and the shutdown wasn't how incoming Nancy Pelosi wants to start her tenure when Democrats take over the House. Democrats in the House want to push through a spending bill without the money President Trump wants for a wall. He is digging in.
Our Border Patrol, our ICE agents, our military, we've done great. But you can never do it perfectly unless you have a wall.
Senate Republicans will not take action without the president's backing.
And that is Ed Donahue with the AP reporting. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is hinting that the goodwill established with the United States in 2018 may not continue into 2019. In his New Year's Day address, Kim said he would be willing to hold another summit with President Trump, but demanded sanctions relief. Most of his New Year speech focused on the North Korean economy and his desire to improve the lives of its citizens, a task that is nearly impossible if trade with North Korea is severely limited. Kim expressed a firm will that North Korea will no longer produce or test nuclear weapons or use or spread its arsenal. Right-wing nationalist Jair Bolsonaro was sworn in as Brazil's president Tuesday in a ceremony at Brazil's National Congress building. Addressing a joint session of Congress minutes after taking the oath, Bolsonaro, a former army captain and admirer of the country's 1964-1985 military dictatorship, vowed to adhere to democratic norms. This is VOA News. The Somali military has executed six al-Shabaab militants without a trial. The militants were executed Sunday by firing squad in the town of Bardhir, about 300 kilometers southwest of Mogadishu. Bardhir, an important agricultural town, was once the main stronghold of al-Shabaab in that region, but the group lost control of its Ethiopian troops in 2015. Relatives of those executed who contacted with VOA from the town described the incident as a summary execution carried out by military forces without a fair trial. There has been no official statement from the Defense Ministry or the Somali National Army's chief on the latest executions. The suspect in the stabbing of three people on New Year's Eve in Manchester was being held under mental health laws. That's according to British police. Manchester police, however, said in a statement that they were continuing to investigate the attack because of suspected terrorism links. A suspect whose identity has not been disclosed has been detained on suspicion of attempted murder. He has not been charged, though. Police released no other details but said the suspect's home was being searched late Tuesday. Australian officials insist that a suspected militant has not been left stateless after he was stripped of his Australian citizenship over his alleged links to the Islamic State terror group. Australia announced this past weekend that Australian-born Neil Prakash had become the 12th dual national to lose Australian citizenship for extremist links. A newspaper reported Wednesday a Fijian official said that Prakash was not a citizen of Fiji. Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton said Australian officials determined that Prakash was a dual national. Well, if losing weight is among your New Year's resolutions, there's a lot of debate over the best way to do it. We get more from AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
Bacon and black coffee or oatmeal and bananas for breakfast. The low-fat versus low-carb debate continues to rage on, with two major studies last year not answering the question of which diet is best. One study finds that low-carb diets and low-fat diets are about equal, with an average 12 to 13 pounds lost. The author says participants in both groups were encouraged to focus on less processed foods and more on produce and meat prepared at home. Everyone is advised to limit sugar and refined flour when trying to shed some pounds. I'm Jackie Quinn.
And sounding like the presidential candidate, he insists he's not. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo unleashed an energetic attack against President Donald Trump's policies Tuesday, pledging New York will lead the nation forward with the most progressive agenda in state history. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bote in Washington. Today is Wednesday, the second day of January, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Congo's government cuts internet connectivity for the second day in a row as the country awaits election results.
The impact is real here. The city is very slow, in part because of the lack of internet. People cannot communicate via social media. They cannot get information through websites. All this is adding to the suspicion that the regime is trying to commit fraud.
That's VOA reporter Abdulrahman Dia in Kinshasa. We'll take a look at the unemployment crisis facing Uganda's youth. The UN says children in conflict face human rights violations, and Cameroon's government seeks to suspend thousands of ghost workers.
You can't continue paying a salary to somebody who doesn't exist. There are some who never work here in the country. They stay abroad. This should stop.
Joseph Leah is Cameroon's civil service minister. Ugandan slum children find hope in chess. And a male campaigner seeks to end FGM in Kenya's Maasai community. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. For the second day in a row, the Democratic Republic of Congo's government on Tuesday cut internet connections and SMS services across the country. This as the country continues to await official results from Sunday's presidential election. A senior advisor to President Joseph Kabila said internet and SMS services were cut to preserve public order after what he calls fictitious results were being circulated on social media. Meanwhile, the Independent Electoral Commission, known as CINE, said on Tuesday that acts of election-related vandalism have been committed in five localities around the country. Joining us from Kinshasa is reporter Abdulrahman Dia of VOA's French Door Africa service, who is covering the Congolese election. Good morning, Abdul, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, James.
You are in Kinshasa, where the people are awaiting the results of their election. We understand the Independent Electoral Commission did come out with a release on Tuesday. What can you tell us?
Exactly. The Electoral Commission started by thanking the people of the DR Congo, congratulating them for voting on Sundays peacefully. And then it went on to confirm that the provisional results would be announced on Sunday at the latest. But what I found most interesting in this press release is that the Electoral Commission says that acts of vandalism have been committed in five localities in the country and that it will file a complaint tomorrow before the judicial authorities. But it did not say how big or how important these acts of vandalism are and how they can impact the whole process. And some are basically saying and accusing the Electoral Commission of sabotaging the process in opposition strongholds.
In other words, the commission did not say which party stronghold did the destruction of materials occur. It didn't say.
They did basically name five cities. They just would not say how big or important those destructions are. They didn't give much details, and that has led to some speculation, people saying that those areas in particular as being opposition strongholds. But we cannot confirm whether those are areas where the opposition did well or not. But whatever it is, the lack of precision from the Electoral Commission is drawing some speculation here.
Abdul, both the opposition and the ruling coalition of President Joseph Kabila came out on Monday saying that their candidates were winning the election. So I'm wondering, what is the overall impact on the general population with this kind of information that's coming out?
Right. Its headquarters are trying to say that they are very confident based on the numbers they are getting from their witnesses. And what I can say is that no one, however, at least officially, is saying that they have officially won so far. They are just trying to show how confident they are. So we don't know how confident they truly are or whether they are just trying to play the opinion. But these days, following the election, have been so far quiet here in Kinshasa, but people do start to worry, and they see this as a long waiting period. They want to basically go on to their normal business, and nobody knows what's going to happen when the results are in fact given. So it's kind of a wait and see situation here.
For the second day in a row, the government came out on Tuesday to cut internet connections and SMS services across the country. I'm wondering, did the government give reasons for this action, and what do you see there as the overall impact in the Kinshasa area or throughout the country?
Well, the government isn't saying anything, but we have heard some members of the presidential majority defending the decision to cut internet, saying that some political party was already giving some false results on the internet and that it was a good decision, actually. But the impact is real here. The city is very slow, in part because of the lack of internet. People cannot communicate via social media. They cannot get information through websites, and all this is adding to the suspicion that the regime is trying to commit fraud. Lamuka, the coalition supporting Martin Fayulu, said just that yesterday. The United States and the European Union, as well as CENCO, which is the Episcopal Church, demanded on Tuesday that internet access be restored. So it's very hard to communicate in Kinshasa.
Abdul, thank you very much again for speaking with us.
Thank you.
House reporter Abdul Rahman Dia of VOA's French to Africa service in Kinshasa, where he's covering Congo's presidential election. This past week, Cameroon's government said it was suspending the payment of wages to 25,000 civil servants whom it says may have died or left the country but continue to defraud the state. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon's finance minister, Louis-Paul Motaze, says after a census of employees taken in April, the government realized it was losing hundreds of millions of dollars every year to people claiming salaries as state workers. Motaze says some had died, but their families and hierarchy did not report their deaths. Others had abandoned their posts or were drawing double salaries with the help of fellow workers. He says they have started removing such workers from the state's payroll.
An average of 310,000 people were concerned. And after this census, we didn't see more than 25,000. That means we are going to suspend them.
Motaze did not say how much money the government will save by eliminating the fictitious state workers. Minister of the Civil Service, Joseph Lay, says this year's census of state workers was very efficient because police tracked down some 8,000 workers who were living in Europe and America.
You can't continue paying a salary to somebody who doesn't exist. There are some who never work here in the country. They stay abroad. And when it started, many Cameroonians came from abroad just to sign their presence here and go back. This should stop.
The government says some of the illegal workers previously lived in the restive English-speaking regions where fighting between government forces and separatists have killed nearly 1,000 people. This is not Cameroon's first purge of so-called ghost workers. The country said in 2015 it was cleaning its payroll of 10,000 dead or fictitious employees who cost it some $12 million every month. However, lawyer Akere Muna, founder of the Cameroon chapter of the anti-corruption watchdog Transparency International, says corruption is widespread in Cameroon and targeting ghost workers will not entirely solve the problem.
Cameroonian civil servants don't live off their salary. They live from a system where they have put toll gates everywhere. You cannot get people who are thieves to look over thieves.
Muna said whistleblowing is the key to fighting graft, but that many people are afraid to come forward as they feel it is too dangerous or ineffective. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Today's Wednesday, the second day of January, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is now 15 minutes past the hour. Over the past year, millions of children in conflict areas have faced life-threatening situations and subjected to gross human rights violations. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, has urged world leaders to do more to protect children in crisis and hold perpetrators accountable. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Violence and insecurity have forced more than 28 million children from their homes in 2018. The UN Children's Fund says it has responded to more than 300 emergencies to help children caught in many of the 40 armed conflicts raging around the world. UNICEF says children are tortured, raped, used as human shields or suicide bombers, recruited as child soldiers, and subjected to a myriad of other atrocities by armed groups. While fighting has killed and maimed tens of thousands of children, UNICEF says many more have died from the indirect consequences of conflict rather than the war itself. For instance, it notes a child dies of preventable diseases every 10 minutes in Yemen, the world's worst humanitarian crisis. President and CEO of UNICEF USA, Carol Stern, tells VOA, food insecurity has caused the rate of severe acute malnutrition to rise, with one in four children around the world being malnourished.
In, for example, the Central African Republic, there's been such a dramatic resurgence in the fighting there, and most of the country is part of it now. So two out of three kids are in need of humanitarian assistance in CAR right now, and 43,000 children below age five, they're projected to face an extremely elevated risk of death due to severe acute malnutrition.
UNICEF reports escalating fighting and attacks on schools and teachers in Cameroon and in the border regions of Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger have deprived millions of children of an education. Similarly, it says ongoing conflict in the Lake Chad Basin is putting the education of 3.5 million children at risk. Stern says sexual violence against women and girls is being used as a weapon of war in many conflicts.
In northeast Nigeria, where you have armed groups, including the Boko Haram, they continue to target girls. This is including rape. This is forced to become wives of fighters. They're used as human bombs. I mean, really what's going on there is just horrific.
Stern says children are abused in all countries and regions of conflict, in Afghanistan, in Myanmar, in Iraq, in Syria, eastern Ukraine, and Central America. She says children are victimized by political leaders who use them as pawns to push a political agenda.
The border of our own country, the various different things that are happening around the world, Bangladesh and Myanmar, we have to separate the issue of politics from the issues that surround children.
Stern says children are not migrants. They are not refugees. They are not Somalia's children or Yemen's children or Syria's children or Rohingya children. She says they are children first and foremost. Stern says there is nothing political about saving the life of a child. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
According to the World Bank, about 77% of Ugandan youth is under 30 years of age. However, the unemployment rate for young people aged 15 to 24 is high, with some estimates putting it at over 70%. But some university graduates have decided not to remain idle. They appreciate work in any form and will do odd jobs that other university graduates would not rather not do. Mugumi Davis Rakarange reports from Kampala.
Dozens of roadside traders call for customers in a busy Nachivubu market in the Ugandan capital, Kampala. One of the traders that has set shop here is Sadi Makanga, an information technology graduate from Makerere University, the oldest university in the country. Makanga's shop is just a small room of 4 by 6 feet that he co-rents with two other traders at a cost of 700,000 Uganda shillings, or about $200 per month. Makanga deals in second-hand clothes and says his business is lucrative. After completing university in 2016, Makanga couldn't find any formal job for 2 years. Makanga says he started his business with 2.5 million Uganda shillings, or about $700 that he got from his relatives and friends.
I've purchased I purchased land and lots of stuff I've done. I look after myself as me, but I've done a lot of things, my way of life. It has improved the standard of living and everything.
Another university graduate that couldn't manage to find a formal job is Maureen Akumu, who deals in mobile money banking. Akumu has a bachelor's degree in social works after graduating in 2008 from Chambogo University. Akumu started her business with a meager 2 million Uganda shillings, or about $500.
I looked for a job for about 6 years. But I could, of course, sometimes I could get contracts with some small organizations, but of course those contracts would not last. Like you get a contract for 2 months, then you sit for about 6 months home. So you realize that the money I get from there could not sustain me. So I had to opt for looking for employment, like employing myself.
Now, Akumu's business has more than doubled and is worth 10 million Uganda shillings, or about $2,700. Yet she has bought a plot of land and plans to open another business outlet. But she says many of her colleagues despise her kind of job. Sadi Makanga agrees.
When you're not at the ground, you can't know the fruits in it. And sincerely speaking, even if it is me, by the time I was at university, I used to see this job as a job of failures. A job of failures, you know. So I don't blame them for that. It looks like that, but deep, deep inside, there's gold. Yeah.
Dickson Aine is the executive director of Sustainable Development Organization, which helps create employment opportunities for young people in Uganda.
Our education system was set on a foundation of creating job seekers, not job creators. So this time round, we want to change it. Like, let's say, okay, you've finished university, but you have that other skill that you can do that will employ you until probably if you want to, you train to be a doctor, until you reach that level where you can actually have your own clinic. But the initial start should start with the skill that you have so that you can employ others.
In his end-of-year message this Monday, Ugandan President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni said his government is determined to end unemployment in the country. President Museveni said his government will provide startup capital and vocational skills so youth can be self-employed. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Female circumcision, a practice that opponents call female genital mutilation, has been a coming-of-age ritual among the Maasai tribe of Kenya for generations. But it is becoming less common, in part because of a man who is trying to persuade tribe members to abandon the practice. Douglas Morite began his campaign about 10 years ago. Rael Ombuo reports from the Kamina settlement in southern Kenya.
Douglas Mirite grew up in the foothills of Mount Kilimanjaro as a member of the Maasai tribe.
I remember when I was in primary school, when I was a young boy, I would look around my class and see only Maasai boys. The girls were from other tribes, but rarely Maasai girls.
Mirite says the girls were being married off at a young age after undergoing female circumcision, a traditional rite of womanhood among the Maasai. But activists call it female genital mutilation, FGM, because of the permanent damage caused by cutting a woman's clitoris. Lilian Ashepai underwent the procedure as a young girl and says excessive bleeding is common and some even die.
We know the girls who have not been circumcised. Sometimes they visit these homes. I ask, where is so-and-so? They say she is here. If she is walking properly, I know that she has not been circumcised. If the girl is not walking properly, we arrest the father and mother.
In the Maasai community, women are the ones who perform the cutting and therefore have the power to end the practice. So Mirite works closely with Maasai women. He says since 2008, he has rescued over 100 girls from FGM, but had to first face off with his own people and tradition.
When we started this campaign, it was difficult. Others would ask, has Douglas gone mad? Even as they continued to speak. This was something that was deep in my heart. I did not give up. When I heard of any form of meeting in the area, I would come in and speak against FGM.
Mugitairi mustiana nimbaya.
Campaigns like Meritei's led to Kenya outlawing FGM in 2011. But the practice still occurs in remote rural areas, says Kimana's chief, Joseph Parumuat.
We work with Douglas to reach such girls. When we get that information, we have police on standby. We go to the location, arrest all those involved, the parents, the person who performed the act, then we take the girl to the rescue center.
According to a 2016 United Nations report, one in five females in Kenya have undergone FGM, but those numbers are going down. Authorities and campaigners, including Meritei, are promoting an alternative rite of passage where girls are graduated into womanhood without the cutting. Rael Umbor, for VOA News, Kimana.
In the Ugandan capital, one man is using the game of kings to help children of the slums. Robert Katende founded the Chess Academy in an effort to keep kids off the streets and teach them the thinking skills to help them get ahead in life. The academy has produced several international competitors and taught hundreds of kids how to play chess. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
It's the beginning of a two-month school break in Uganda, and for poor families in the Katwe slum, getting food for their kids will only get harder. But many children can get meals at the Som Chess Academy. Funded by Samaritans, the academy provides lunch every day, along with the chance for children to develop skills by playing chess. Founder and head coach Robert Katende, who grew up in the slum, says the academy has restored hope for many of these children.
Especially the girls who before thought they had nothing to really achieve in life because of the culture, because of the society, them being marginalized, growing them up just to become mothers, now dreaming big to be a professionals in different fields.
Nansubuga Gloria, an orphan who was abandoned by her mother when she was 11, is now Uganda's first player to be a Women's World Chess Federation Master, the third highest ranking in the chess world. The journey has not been easy for the 17-year-old.
Because there is a time I wanted to quit. When I used to go to international tournaments and I used to come back when I've lost. Because my coach used to tell me, let's go, maybe we'll get a candidate master title. But even a candidate master title, I couldn't reach to it. So my hope was down.
In 2014, the academy created a special program for disabled slum children. Dennis Mwesige started playing chess in 2004 and in August represented Uganda at the 43rd Chess Olympiad in the United States, winning a bronze medal.
It has changed my life. I can use hands to play chess, even mouth, and I know to do computers.
In 2010, Som Chess Academy sent 14-year-old Fiona Mutesi to the 39th Chess Olympiad in Russia. Her story was later turned into a movie entitled Queen of Katwe. Perhaps one day, with one move at a time, Uganda will not just produce chess movie stars, but the next Garry Kasparov or Bobby Fischer. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Nicholas Hissam, Special Representative of the United Nations Secretary General for Somalia, has been asked by the Somali government to leave the country. The government-controlled media said the decision came after the highest UN diplomat in Somalia violated the agency's standards and international diplomatic norms by intervening in the national sovereignty of Somalia. The statement gave no further details. That's it for this Wednesday, January 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Carl Sterling. I'm James Barton, Washington, saying have a lovely day, Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.